So it's an honor to sit here with you all, online and in person, and going to continue based on the wonderful offerings of my illustrious colleague, Suze, this question of how we can apply the four immeasurables to this moment, to 2024, when the world has all kinds of political and cultural divisions, and it's hard to navigate. And I'm going to do this without mentioning any political names or really even getting into that, because that's not the point. The point is, how do we go deep into our practice, into the insight that it offers us and that the four immeasurables are based on, to navigate this differently? And it's the very essence of the Brahmaviharas that they kind of are the opposite of our lesser instincts, our default instincts to attack one another and defend ourselves. It takes us beyond that, because it really brings us into who we really are and who others really are. So that's why it's so important to apply them not just when it's easy, but in particular, when it's hard. That's when they're useful. That's when it's critical. That's when it really works. And that's what these great masters were pointing at. And I've never been Christian. And that gives me an advantage when reading the words of Jesus, because I can really see his wisdom. So I'm going to quote from the Sermon on the Mount here, where Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." So isn't that amazing? You know, he's pointing out, yeah, it's easy to be kind and loving and compassionate towards those we're close to. The heavy lift is when they aren't. So this perfect, what does that mean? Since we aren't perfect until we're Buddhas, until we're awakened, so what is a Buddha suggesting we practice in this, you know, difficulty of human relations? And the one way of looking at this is the core of the issue is that all sentient beings can awaken to Buddhahood. That's what the Buddha taught. Therefore, this means all sentient beings, even the ones whose actions seem abhorrent. In the numerical discourses, the Buddha said, the mind is clear, luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. My favorite Dharma quote. I use it all the time. And it just captures the innate simplicity of the path. You know, there's obscurations that block our innate nature of mind, the not clinging that we reveal through practice. And as we become mindfully aware of those obscurations, as we slowly untangle the tangle, the nature of mind is revealed. That's how the journey works. So any of us, including myself, who are not yet awakened, that's because this freedom is still obscured. That's the journey. We're still obscured. There's stuff. There's conditions. Karmas, maybe. We're still obscured. And each one of us, and each one of you out there in Zoom and everybody, has unique sets of conditions that comes from who knows where, maybe other lifetimes. Here we are. And that's our reality that we kind of live in. But nothing that obscures anyone is inherent to that person. It's just conditions. All the things you don't like about the people you don't like aren't inherent to them. They came from somewhere. And this is where, right in here, is where in this intersection our collisions with difficult people is where the truth of not self, of emptiness, becomes really tangible and really useful. Because as we practice, that helps us untangle our own tangles and helps us understand the tangles of others. There's freedom there. So, you know, think about your own practice. When we're meditating, I'm sure you've all had this experience, like all of our difficult stuff comes up. You know what I mean? Like, oh, especially in a long retreat, you know, all of the weird things we did to our little brother or whatever, all of the abhorrent ideas we repeatedly have or the things we're obsessed with, it all comes up. It's like, oh my God, who's that? We almost don't recognize ourselves, but there you are. And in the process of seeing it, which is the brave part, the warrior aspect, then we start to unwind it. And it becomes less and less and less a compulsion and more an observation. And the mists become clearer. That's how it works. Just in that seeing is non-identification, is knowing that's not us, that's just something. Just growing freedom, just when we see it. We see the parts that make up our sense of self. We see the causes and conditions. We start to see that nothing is inherent there, that it's all changeable. And we start to see compassion towards ourselves. It's funny how we start to see kind of a kindness towards ourselves. Does that sound familiar? Kindness and compassion, verse 2 of the Brahma Viharas, it just kind of emerges naturally toward ourselves. Now remember that in the instructions on meditation, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha very clearly says to be mindful internally and externally. This is really important, internally and externally. Because externally, much of it means all of everybody around us, all the beings that we encounter, be mindful of them, of what's arising in them, just like we're mindful of what's arising in us. And as you read the suttas and watch what the Buddha did for 40 years of teaching, that's exactly what he did. He was externally mindful constantly, because all the suttas are little encounters with people, many of whom are difficult people doing very strange things. Came up again and again. That's why there's this incredible list. The Vinaya is this incredible list of rules for monastics. Each one of those is some weird thing someone did. So we said, well, don't do that. Okay, don't do that. Don't have sex with animals. That's not good. You know, it goes on and on. But that's how it happened, because he was around these people. But you can see that he always recognized the possibility in each being to awaken, to become a Buddha just like he was. And that's exactly what we're called to do in our relations with everybody, including the really difficult ones, okay? Especially the really difficult ones. Case in point, who knows about Angulimala? Ring a bell, Angulimala? World's first serial killer that the Buddha encountered. He'd killed 999 people, and he wanted the Buddha to be the 1,000th, so he could have Angulimala is a necklace, mala, Anguli's fingers. He had a necklace of 999 fingers and wanted the Buddha's finger to be the 1,000th. I won't go into the whole tale, which is worth reading, but the point is that the Buddha did not see this serial killer as an inherently evil person. He saw his potential to awaken, and he saw that Angulimala's actions were a product of causes and conditions. And so when they encountered Angulimala's chasing him with a big sword to kill him, the Buddha said, stop, Angulimala. And somehow Angulimala got it, what he really meant, to drop it. And he did. He dropped it. And he became a monastic. And he became an arhat in that lifetime. So think about it. You know, the despot who you dislike the most, no matter how difficult they are, they probably didn't kill 999 people personally, right? Is there anybody that we know of that we really dislike who actually killed 999 people themselves? So it opens up a whole world of how we can relate to difficult people, thinking about the example the Buddha set. And we often think, when we think of difficult people, that they must be somehow intrinsically warped. And that's how we justify really disliking them. And that's how our visceral response is. Get it? I understand that. But this is where the practice takes us through that. So it's no longer, we're no longer defined by that. And we could look at how Jesus was talking and how Buddha's talking about the reality of what these people really are, of what we really are, especially the difficult ones. And when we turn our external mindfulness to difficult persons, we start to see that there's no intrinsically evil being there. There are, in fact, causes and conditions. It's pretty interesting. Now remember, Buddha taught not self. There's no inherent self as one of the three characteristics of reality. So therefore, there is no intrinsic being to hate, whether we're talking about self-hatred or hatred of others. It doesn't exist. And as we practice the four Brahma Viharas, they naturally emerge. It's sort of the nature of the Dharma. As we practice everything the Buddha taught, it emerges. And if you kind of read it, then it becomes clear. Oh, that's what he meant. And sometimes something will emerge, and then you read it and go, oh yeah, I was seeing that. You know, it kind of works both ways, but the Brahma Viharas naturally emerge. And this, as a tiny caveat, just want to say, the point of this is not to be, you know, passive in the world. We can take positions. We can take action. We can be activists. You know, I personally, I've been arrested. I've been in demonstrations. I've worked on a lot of campaigns, done a whole bunch of stuff. But the point is how we are with the people we're acting against, perhaps, how we are with them. Then take action. Go for it. But don't hate. That's the point. Remember back in the day, in the 60s, remember SDS, does that ring a bell for anyone? Students for Democratic Society. That was the big radical group in the late 60s during the Cambodia riots. And I was at University of Wisconsin. It was like burning, literally a Kroger burned to the ground during those demonstrations. And there was 10,000 riot police and barricades all over the city. It was wild. And the SDS got really hateful about other. And that's where I pulled out. I just, no, that's not it. I was starting to meditate then. And I was like, nope, that's not it. It's not. So you can be active, just don't hate. Okay. So I want to work through the ultimate level, in a sense, of the four Brahma Viharas that we've been exploring. Just see how they can help us navigate difficult people in 2024. And one thing to, work on about these is they're not emotions. You know, loving kindness is not an emotion we're going to feel. It's an attitude. It's a practice that we cultivate. It's an attitude towards other beings. So, because often people say, oh, I don't feel that, so it must not be working. That's not exactly it. We cultivate an attitude in all these arenas. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And of the four, one could say, loving kindness, metta, was best articulated by the Buddha. He kind of, in the Metta Sutta in particular, he really laid it out what it is. It's the best, you know, that's what people teach the most. It's the best entry point to all four. And the word in English is weird because when we say love, we think emotional love, we think love of parent and child, we think all kinds of like aspects of that which we call love that have to do with attachment and identification and me, you know, my child or my partner or my this or that. But love, metta, is infinitely broader, includes all beings, and thus inherently those who seem to us to be enemies. So I'm going to read a little bit of the Metta Sutta and then break it apart a little bit, break it apart, offer some sense of it to see if this might be helpful. In part of it, Buddha said, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Now, this is, of course, a high bar, but that's okay, to cherish all living beings. But coded into this are some perspectives that really help us understand what it means to cultivate loving kindness towards difficult beings. So I'm going to go through this a little bit and see if this is just what I pick up from this and teachings I've had, and et cetera. But the way the Buddha frames it takes the whole question about who we like and who we don't like, just takes it away. It makes it way bigger than that. It's not personal. He says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So isn't that interesting? Not to despise any being in any state. That's pretty pointed. He said it right up front. So therefore, the most despicable despot is included in that. Any being in any state. Can't despise them. Shouldn't despise them. And not to wish harm upon another. You know, sometimes we find ourselves wishing harm upon those with whom we disagree. That's not so good. He said, don't do that. You know, even the people that are doing really bad stuff, we think. Don't do that. So he goes, if you read this a certain way, he's going directly. He's not talking about the nice stuff. He's going directly to the difficult. Boom. That's where he starts. It's pretty powerful. And to be sure, we might be inclined to despise someone because we think there's some reason, some damage they caused, pain they've inflicted. But nonetheless, there's a deeper way to look at it, which the Buddha is suggesting that's an antidote to getting stuck there. And then the next four lines, the Buddha says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. So I'm not a mother, but I am a parent. And in my own experience and talking to many other parents over many years, sometimes one's own offsprings are the most difficult beings imaginable, right? It's not cakewalk. It's not a cakewalk. I mean, they tell us we're stupid. They trash our cars. They get addicted on drugs. They diddle away their educational opportunities. And we're called to cultivate love toward them because we're their parents. So it's not kind of like, you know, oh, you just crashed your car. I love you. It's not like that. It may be tough love, but it is a dedication to the well-being of those beings. In the same way, we're called to have a dedication to the well-being of all beings. It's not that different. So we don't love sometimes these children as the mother he's talking about because it feels good or there's anything even lovable. But we just know that's the only choice that we have is to cultivate love towards those beings. It's our calling as parents to cultivate that, even when it's really hard, which sometimes really is. But we know that these offspring, they depend on us to be consistent there, to maintain this kindness, because when young people are kind of out of control there, they've lost their compass. And I've found, and you know, with my own, to my own kids, you know, two of whom had addiction issues for a number of years, and it was pretty gnarly. But the way in which my wife and I, you know, stepkids to be sure, but kept ourselves on the rails, kept positive attitudes, stayed open, listened, and exercised tough love and all that stuff, helped them find their compass because there was somewhere they could turn where there was sanity and listening. So this is kind of how we are in the world, which is why the Buddha, I think, is so brilliant. Because the Buddha protects with her life her child, her only child, with a boundless heart. That's how we should cherish all living beings, no matter how gnarly they are. And then the last lines, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. So notice he did say free from hatred and ill will, as if that's how we're doing it. He's saying this is how we are freed from it. It untangles us from it, having this radiating kindness. And also, that's interesting language, radiating kindness. It's not talking about being all loving in a personal way. It's just this great energy of caring and of kindness. So it's way bigger than anything about emotion or attachment or me and mine or my sweetheart. It's way bigger than that. You know, in conventional reality, we love a beloved who might be, you know, attractive or talented or simpatico, but then if they're not, then that's difficulter, which is the very nature of marriage, right? There's this beloved part, and then the beloved becomes a difficult person, and how you navigate that is the journey of marriage, which we do to varying degrees of success. But he's talking about this kindness, completely different realm. And then that brings us to being freed from hatred and ill will. So that was the trap, to be caught in hatred and ill will. How amazing is that? Then the last three Brahmaviharas, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity, there's a way in which they reveal this ultimate teaching of a boundless heart towards beings and of the empty nature of selfing and all phenomena. They're all baked in there. There is no inherent self anywhere we can't intrinsically hate. It's just baked in there. And on a conventional level, we might dislike this person or that person and agree and disagree and okay. But ultimately, each person is empty of an inherent self. Therefore, there's nobody there to hate. And there's also nobody here to hate that other person. That's a whole other, but it can't happen. If we really see that, then it doesn't happen. And you get back to the Buddha. You look at his life. He never hated anybody, even the Dalai Lama. You know, in this very age, I mean, you think about it, if you know a little bit about Tibetan history in the 20th century, a million Tibetans died at the hands of the Chinese invaders. Almost all the monasteries were destroyed. About 90% of the monastics were killed. I mean, it's pretty horrendous. But what the Dalai Lama always talks about is compassion for the Chinese leaders who did that, in terms of their karma and where it may land them in future lifetimes. That's what he talks about. He never veers into hatred towards anybody. And even though he deeply feels the pain, he lost his country, all these people died, it's incredible. And that's how he always responds. So this is not just like way back the Buddha 2,600 years ago. He's still alive right now. So compassion. It really clarifies all this, because we cultivate compassion for others' suffering, their dukkha, a hope that they be free of suffering. And suffering is not about outward conditions or difficult. That's only pain. You know, pain is one thing. Everybody's going to have pain. That's an outward condition. Suffering is about how people respond to phenomena. That's how we cling, how we identify. That's what makes dukkha happen. An awakened being, as the Buddha himself did, or anybody, can have extraordinary pain, physical pain, but they're okay because they're not attached. So dukkha is really, suffering is really about our lack of awakening, and compassion is wishing that beings can be free of that. Ultimately, that's what it is. So this is the second of the Brahmaviharas. And we can cultivate compassion almost inherently for the most reprehensible among us, because we see just how bleak is their karma and just how dark are their prospects and just how defeated they are, maybe in future lifetimes, by their own conditioning and by the actions they've been taking. It makes your heart ache to see someone who's doing horrendous things, and you kind of go, oh my God, what's that going to be like for them next lifetime? Truly. So it just brings it right out of us. If you really look clearly at not this being we think is despicable, but the repercussions of what they're choosing to do, just like the Dalai Lama is. So here in 2024, you know, we can cultivate compassion for political leaders with whom we disagree the most, whether in this country or not. You know, North Korea, Myanmar, the Sudan, there's political leaders doing pretty horrendous things. And it's a real time to cultivate compassion for them, because they've dug themselves into a real pickle. And it just makes your heart ache what's going to be there for them. A sympathetic joy is, to be sure, for me at least, the hardest to kind of attune how to cultivate toward difficult beings. But I think in that difficulty, there is something to see. And I'll say this is a work in progress for me, so I'm interested in what I learn. But you might wonder why we would cultivate sympathetic joy towards someone whose actions we abhor, because if they're happy about a horrendous action, how could we have sympathetic joy for that? And I think on a certain level we can't. If it's a horrendous action, if it harms other beings, then there's no sympathetic joy about that. But when we start to look at that, we kind of realize what we inherently do is we create this kind of caricature of a despicable person in which that's all that they are. They're evil, evil, evil. Everything they do is horrible. Oh my God, they're just evil. So the one place I've found that this is really heart-opening is actually to look into the lives of truly difficult people and to give a sense of the conditions, for one thing, because there's often really extraordinary conditions that have a lot to do with why they are so difficult in this lifetime. And also, often, there's little glimmers of kindness that catch you in the most surprising places. And I won't talk about current people because I'm not doing that. But Stalin, for example, was kind of good to his mother. He cared for her. It's a little bit of a dodgy relationship, but nonetheless, he made sure she was taken care of and he had a sense of, you know, he loved her in his own Stalin way. And Hitler, despite, you know, God knows, we know what Hitler did, but he was very kind to his dogs. He really loved animals. He's a vegetarian, in fact, and actually lectured people about not killing animals to eat them. He did. Hitler did. Yep, he lectured his staff. He gave them rewards if they'd be vegetarian. It's true. And he was very kind to his staff, by the way. He really treated people well. There's a wonderful movie. It's called Hitler's Secretary, a woman who was, in fact, his secretary, who was down in the bunker with him until just before he committed suicide. And it's an amazing movie. She just came out right at the end of her life and just, she had never talked to hardly anybody about it. And he was a great boss. He was good. He wasn't a butthead boss. We've all had butthead bosses. Hitler wasn't one of them, right? How strange is that? So I'm not saying I'm like a Hitler fan, but when you do that, it kind of opens your heart and you can have sympathetic joy for those aspects of that person. And you can start to wait, okay, there's not this concretized, rigid being. There's a complex person with all these contradictions. You ever thought I'm a mass of contradictions? I sometimes do. You know, we've got these different parts. So even those people are like that. And it can help us, because here we are back here, our job is to not concretize hatred toward another and ourselves. And it helps us unpack that if these horrendous beings had these amazingly almost endearing qualities, then there's sympathetic joy. That's one way. That's what I'm offering. It's one way of looking at it. So we can rejoice in whatever kindness there was, even if it was a little thing, and whatever, you know, kind happiness they might have felt. It's pretty interesting. Little rays of light that can be an exercise in heart opening, move us away from concretization of self and other. Because if we concretize others, we're going to concretize ourselves. You know, and like, you know, Dalai Lama's great story, how one of those Mind and Life conferences years ago, and there were some Western psychologists, and someone brought up this thing about, you know, so many Westerners are filled with self-hatred. And Dalai Lama was like, what? He couldn't even get it. It's like they had to go back and forth in Tibetan before he understood actually they were really actually talking about self-hatred, because he couldn't even get his head around it. Because how could they? It's just conditions. Who's the head? You know, what are you talking about? It's really amazing. So, insofar as we hate others, we probably hate ourselves. So this is a mutual win-win here. And then lastly, equanimity in this arena it's like a bridge into wisdom. I love equanimity because in the four Brahma Viharas, equanimity, it walks us into the wisdom, the prajna, the wisdom aspect, the seeing of emptiness. And so it's here that this core understanding we've been exploring, there's no inherent being who is evil, it really bears fruit in this fourth of the Brahma Viharas. Because as you cultivate equanimity, in the very process of it, equanimity, this balance, it's not flatlined, it's balance of wisdom and mindfulness. And we look mindfully at each being and we see that each is no different from the other. It's just, there's an aware sentient being overlaid with conditioning. That's the whole deal. The mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. That deal. So in equanimity, we see that all beings have the same potential. And that gives us, in our own lives, stability as we move through the morass of difficulties and difficult people and conflicts. And we're moving toward how a Buddha sees beings, because a Buddha sees each sentient being as the same. And the characteristics that keep them from being awakened are just conditioning, like Angulimala. And it's possible, probable, will happen to be freed of those. So how sacred we all are. And no matter what situation, we go to Walmart, what a mess. Sacred beings. It's really amazing. And we're able to respond. As we cultivate equanimity, then we can respond to poorly motivated actions with loving kindness, with compassion, with sympathetic joy. It all kind of comes out inherently. And equanimity arises from our mindfulness practice because we're inherently seeing the not self of things, the emptiness of things, the impermanence of things. That's insight. So nobody's an enemy. Everybody is sentience overlaid with conditions. And the nature of conditions is that they can change. So it unpacks a lot of the difficulty. And it can be really, really transformational in difficult times. I mean, it's a lovely thing. I know it's true that, again, I won't name names, but I know many of Dharma brothers and sisters who keep photos of particularly difficult political individuals on their altars to give them loving kindness just to counter their default, which would be the opposite. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. So this helps us awaken in the middle of the mess of the world. And in fact, this is part of what Dharma practitioners offer in the middle of the mess of the world, because we're not identified. You know, we've learned to hold this lightly. We've learned to see through the conditionings. And it's hard for folks out there. It really is. It's way hard. And young people, I mean, you know, climate change, like God knows what it's going to be like in 100 years. And nuclear, there's a lot of really spooky things right now, to be sure. But to be able to work on this level and find your own freedom is a gift. So let's just sit for a moment.